Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And here we are. We're getting to the end of the summer.
It's exciting. I love fall.
Bunch of kids are back in school.
I know. It seems so early. So quick.
I always panic.
Why?
Well, one, because school always kind of freaked me out. And two,
it's a big change in your lifestyle. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're a kid. You know, you're having fun. You're barefoot. You're out looking for tadpoles, running around in the dirt. And then playing in the water.
Were you Huck Finn when you grew up?
I was, actually. I lived in North Carolina when I was a little girl. That is exactly. I was in my
bare
feet
on a raft?
All summer long. No, but I was on one a lot.
Did you make tadpole pie and stuff like that?
No, of course.
Okay.
Of course.
All right.
You know it.
Well, my panic was always, like, I missed all these things, right? So I figure we should talk about, well, what are the things that we're about to not be able to cook or not be able to eat?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the end of summer regret program.
Dun, 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 dun.
Exactly.
I got it.
No, but I mean, it's kind of a...
Well, I love change of seasons. I think it's exciting, but it is going to be sad when certain things aren't around anymore.
Every year is like...
tomatoes are a big one.
I get the phone call from the first farmer. Like, I have tomatoes. I'm like...
Yeah, finally, yay.
I'm looking at the calendar. I'm like, sure you do. And they're not yours. And then I get the next call.
Oh,
sure you do. They're not nice. And then miraculously, every year... If it's heirlooms that you want, somewhere right around between the 25th and the 28th of July. Someone comes up with, it's just like asparagus.
Trigger.
It's like, it'll show up in the markets before that,
but there is
the right time, and it's based on where the sun is.
It's just astonishing the change
and that's
in
why
texture
we feel the change.
And
yeah.
Flavor. The flavor and the texture of a ripe, gorgeous tomato is one of the most beautiful things you can eat, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, they're about to go away, Sin.
I know.
Because
I know.
The call that they don't want to give you is that they're about to go away.
I know, and we all have so many different menu items with tomatoes in because we really do. We really celebrate them.
People at home
do
all their things.
They're healthy. They're wonderful. They're bright. They're fresh. They're gorgeous. I was talking to one of my new cooks about, you know, I said, look at the way that Lucas is plating this dish. It's a tomato salad with goat cheese mousse, which we pipe on, a fresh basil oil, and extra virgin olive oil as well, wild Spanish extra virgin olive oil, a little salt and pepper, little greens. It's not complicated, but every single time it's plated, it's a work of art. It truly is, because actually heat draws, which is very cool for a cook, and he obviously has an artistic eye. And every time he slices, you know, and I swear sometimes the salad's way too big when it goes out because we do have a tasting menu format, and I don't even care because it's just so gorgeous. And if the guest doesn't feel like eating it,
that's
all,
the size
that's okay.
It needs to be beautiful.
Exactly.
Lucas,
and it's just,
right?
it is. It's just so pretty. So, yeah, we're really going to miss the tomatoes. But and we're going to miss crab meat too.
Well, yeah, and that's and in Maryland, we have that, like, privilege of – we know we're the world epicenter of crabs, right?
For sure.
So the change with the crabs at the end of the season, it's not like tomatoes where you'll still see some in the market, and some will show up a little bit, but...
Well, I think it's dependent on the watermen, too, you know?
Last year, Indian summer tomatoes are actually pretty good.
Okay.
Which is unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have confidence in that this year. The changes for crabs mean what? Soft shells are going to go away.
Oh, gosh. And, you know, people around here, and I love that about this community because, frankly, I lived in Indiana. Of course, nobody in Indiana, at least when I was growing up, would have had any idea what a soft shell crab was and probably would have been freaked out by it. Living in Charleston, for some reason, they just weren't popular down there. So, I think I saw my mom eat a soft shell crab once. When I was living in Charleston, and I tasted it, and frankly, I was a little bit kind of thought it was odd. It's something you just have to understand.
If you're not from Maryland, you think it's a fried giant spider.
Well, no, it's not that. It's just the idea of everybody knows a crab has a hard shell, so it's sort of hard to get your mind wrapped around the fact that this molted, you know, product, this crab, actually is in a soft shell that really, truly is edible. And of course, you have to know what you're doing when you're selling them, too, as a chef.
They can be a little bit too firm. We take joy in eating the malted product.
They're so good. The malted. They're so good. And it's so much fun to eat the whole thing. And they're so good fried. I love them.
So the last three crab things you're going to do before they go away.
Well,
and that you would do at home or that someone could do at home.
Well, just a really, really good crab salad because I don't make that. And, you know, we make crab cakes and
You have made the crab and corn salad.
Right. I haven't done that in years. And that is really, really, and I've talked about that on the radio before. Yeah. And, you know, you came up with that salad, and it's just one of my absolute favorites, which is quite simply sort of two layers, which is the roasted corn, which I, of course, roast the local sweet corn in the husk for about 35 to 45 minutes in a 325 degree convection oven. So if you don't have a convected oven, it's going to take a little bit longer. Then when it's cool, we pull the husk off and cut it off the cob. And obviously, you do not scrape the cob for this. You want to just have the good sweet corn. And mix it with a little bit of mayonnaise, lemon verbena, shallot, very finely chopped shallot, very finely chopped celery, salt and pepper. And I like to add a little lime juice to it as well. And lemon verbena is not really that nice in your mouth. It has almost like little thistly weirdness on the leaves. It's a pretty fine leaf. You really don't like to eat it. You made an oil with it or a vinaigrette
It does pretty well when you crush it in
but
a mortar and pestle.
Yeah. You have to really chop it fine if you're going to add it directly to food. And it makes a gorgeous oil because there is so much oil in it inherently. And it, oh my gosh, it's just like the
perfume.
Most beautiful perfume in the world. One of my favorite chefs in France, Michel Gérard, he's in Eugénie-les-Bains, which is a spa area. They have the sulfur springs there. And his family, it's actually his wife's family hotel and spa, has been there for a very long time. And they must grow fields of lemon verbena. They have lemon verbena soap. They have shampoo, everything. He serves sorbet. He serves, you know, when you sit down to eat dinner there in his 3-star or any of his other restaurants, you're going to have something that has lemon verbena in it. And it's just, it's a gorgeous thing. And it's not the easiest thing to grow. I'm growing 3 pots. It's never gotten any further from the little tiny plant to, I mean, it might be a foot tall now. And I've had it since the beginning of summer, spring, really. So they are very slow growing. And that's why I planted 3 pots of it. That's a very simple, and you can basically treat the crab the same way. I would just send the same mayonnaise in with all those ingredients with the crab. Obviously, anytime you're with crab meat, you want the shells, you want to touch the crab gently to remove any shell. You never want to break up the lump or any of the nice pieces. And, you know, look for anything else. Sometimes there's just little other things in there, and you just want to make sure that the crab meat is very clean and that it's sweet and smells great.
What kind of crab meat do you like to work with the
I
best?
Do like jumbo lump, but it is very expensive, so.
And you're talking about the fresh.
Fresh.
And local if you can get it.
Local if you can get it, and all the way down through the southern part of the United States. That's where we buy crab meat for the restaurant.
And you get inconsistencies when you get the Venezuelan product or the Philippine product.
And it's a different type of crab. I don't want to be totally, you know, make a statement about it, but I do think so what I serve is that American East Coast crab meat.
My friend Johnny Apple, R.W. Apple, who wrote for the Times for so long, God rest him.
Amazing man, yes.
I think probably the only person I know with as many opinions as me.
He was an extraordinary person. I think definitely top 2 people I'd like to sit down and eat dinner with again. Sad that he's passed away.
We always had a great time together.
His books are amazing. Everyone should
told
go
a million
buy
stories. One of the things we always talked about is what's the best of this? What's the best of that? What do you think of, you know, this wine or this food? And he always said that the only crab meat that compares with the local, with the Chesapeake, the only crab meat that compares in flavor with the blue crab in the Chesapeake, and he worked really hard to eat his way around the world twice, which is pretty good. Once you give him a couple glasses of Chateauneuf enough to pop at lunch, you get some pretty good stories. And one of the stories is about eating these crabs in Sri Lanka.
Oh,
and that's the only thing that measures up to.
I'm very surprised that was the answer. That's cool.
But yeah,
that's
said everything else just. And honestly, I've not had the time in Asia. So I'm gonna
sure.
give him credit for that because he's pretty on target on things.
Mm-hmm.
But had enough time in a lot of places in Europe to know it's and even some in the Caribbean. It's just not the same.
I think the love for crab meat in this area is very wonderful and amazing, and it's so strong. I mean, I don't have to say that for any Marylanders that are listening because you all know yourselves. But even when I worked, and because I have worked in other states, when I worked in South Carolina, if you made she crab soup, which is a traditional, pretty old soup, you know, from the early 1900s, it's not hundreds of years old, but they would use back fin. or claw meat. And I grew up with parents from York, Pennsylvania, who loved crab. Well, my mother loved crab meat, so she always looked for lump. And so I did have crab meat growing up whenever we went up to York. And my goodness, you know, it's just funny. I think that they really exported everything out of South Carolina. I don't know if it's still that way. I mean, it's been, you know, 25 years since I was working in Charleston, but...
Well, it's because that's shrimp land, right? I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah, definitely. The creek shrimp and oysters, oysters everywhere. Certainly grouper, tilefish.
Oysters up here are much nicer.
Oh, no. I think that's... Now that, I think, is...
You're going to get in trouble.
Those are fighting words. No, I think oysters are certainly what you've grown up on, and it's your flavor. It's your personal flavor profile. And oysters, I mean, my mother would say absolutely oysters from the Chesapeake Bay. She did grow up on them, and she loves oysters. Fried oysters are one of her favorite. When she comes and eats my food, she has fried oysters.
Cindy, you should listen to your mother.
Oh.
She's probably right.
Well, one of the fun things that they used to do in Charleston with oysters, and I had never had this before I started working there, was steamed oysters. Oh, my gosh. I love steamed oysters. And I was never a big raw, when I was a kid, I was never a big raw oyster person, but certainly steamed oysters with melted butter sitting outside. Well, back then for me, I would actually drink a beer and, oh, my gosh, so much fun. And then they would have oyster roasts, which I think those are probably the best way to eat a cooked oyster in the world. And that's outside.
Well, see,
you know,
but you said it.
Over embers of a fire.
A cooked oyster.
Yeah. Yeah.
That means that you don't know.
Oh, I used to eat
what
you're
doing.
Gosh, here we go. Here we go. It's a sweeter oyster from that part of the water. That's for sure. Up here, they're saltier.
It means it doesn't have the nice salty flavor that
we
have.
Yeah, up here, they're saltier. No, oysters up here are delicious. Don't you try to get me in trouble, Tony Foreman.
I would never.
So what are you?
I would never. And so the other thing that it's funny, I was talking about Johnny Apple. The other thing he talked about is, because he's not a Maryland guy, but he lived in D.C. a long time, is that he couldn't handle drinking beer with crabs.
Okay.
He was the guy who drank wine, and he liked it a lot. But he kept asking me, what is the best way? How do I drink wine with crabs and eat crabs at a crab feast?
Can I guess? Is it Viognier? Are you going to say Viognier?
No.
Oh, good. Okay, good.
He was also a fellow. Look, Johnny was a fellow famous for these, like, very seriously plaid shirts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, checked shirts. Something with a bold. He was not a particularly shy man. He was brilliant and not shy. And he'd have these bold pattern or bold check shirts on. And I can imagine him being a little fastidious about things and having hands full of whether it's Old Bay or whatever other seasoning somebody was using. And how do you, like, grab a glass, you know, it's sort of terrible. And I was like, well, you just put it in a jar. You put it in a glass jar or something or a coffee mug or something that you wouldn't feel like. It's not, if it's on a jar that you get all that goo, it's not disgusting. It's just kind of like, well, I'm being casual.
Right.
You know, and he kind of made a face about it, but he said it. Then afterwards, he said he'd done it, and he's like, "You know, you're right. I don't feel as weird about that kind of thing as having some kind of wine glass." He's like, "Well, what wine do you put in the jar?" It's like, "Do you put something nice?" I'm like, "Well, do you want to drink something nice?"
Yes.
I mean,
of course.
What do you want? You want it to be cold.
Mm-hmm.
Sparkling is not a bad idea. Something with a lot of oaky flavors is probably kind of silly because you're talking about like sweet crab and some spices. You know, so what do you want? You want something refreshing, you know? Pick some kind of crunchy, fruity white, Riesling, Sancerre, Alsatian wine, Spanish white wine from Galicia, all that kind of stuff is great. Vino verde, cheap, easy, low alcohol, which means you can have more of it.
Vino verde.
Yeah, exactly.
Fun to say, too.
Well, all right, we're going to come back in a little bit on Foreman & Wolf on food and wine and our summer regrets, no, our finishing up summer program. And have a chef's challenge and talk about harvest upcoming.
Yes, that'll be interesting.
All of that and more, and hopefully not too many more arguments about oysters on WYPR. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're wrapping up summer.
We're talking about crabs and should probably give out a recipe of yours. What do you like to make
a
with crab?
Of mine?
Yeah, you didn't talk about something that...
Well, the thing that when I was a kid that I always thought was cool, if my dad took us to the various sort of seafood restaurants that were like there were a million of when I was a kid, and there still are around, crab fluff is a thing that I liked. And crab fluff is kind of like... I thought what it was supposed to be was sort of like a beignet or a donut, you know, what the Spaniards call a buñuelo, with crab meat. But it would always, like, come out of the fryer and, like, be dusted in Old Bay or something. And maybe the fryer oil wasn't always nice.
That's a big deal. And, it's got to be fresh.
Yeah, and it doesn't. And this is a thing where the crab meat can be fresh. It doesn't have to be big lumps. It literally is just enough to flavor this batter that, you know, it's kind of a messy thing. But when I was a kid, like the couple of times I had it when it was good, I really liked it.
I bet.
And one thing I did not long ago for a charity dinner was try to it, being arrogant, I tried to like recreate the idea of crab fluff or redo it in a totally different way, or the way I thought it was supposed to be when I was a kid. And part of it had to do with making the seasoning mixture the way that I wanted it to be. And so I just, you know, used the old dandy mortar and pestle and ground up my own version of, not Old Bay exactly. I thought, well, what are the things that I like and what are the things that I don't like? What is too much in there? What's too little in there? I love the mustard seed in there. I love the spice in there, but there are other peppers, there are other dried peppers that I like better. There's a Korean dried pepper that I love to death. That I put into that mixture, and a little bit of cumin, but not too much, a little bit of annatto, and fresh coriander seeds, and all of those guys, ground them up lightly, sea salt, so I could dust the fluff with that, and used a buñuelo batter, which is something we eat, a very Catalan, all over Spain you see these things, and the crab meat. Tossing the crab meat in lemon and olive oil, and with the batter, mixing in a little bit of steeped saffron. So it had this like wonderfully glowing sort of, you know, yellow color and a little bit of the perfume. When you tear open the little donuts, you tear it open and it has that perfume from the saffron and the delicate crab. That was nice. But that's probably my favorite thing. And the buñuelo batter is really easy to look up. There, any well-known Spanish cookbook author, even Jose Andreas will have with the tapas restaurants will have a respectable buñuelo batter. That's a grandma thing.
I think one of the other things that I have always enjoyed making, when we used to have she crab soup on the menu a lot, was making my own crab stock, and you know, getting in the hard crabs live, breaking them up. You know, we would pretty well quarter them.
I'm picturing you walking around the kitchen, jumping up and down on live crabs.
I would use a cleaver to break
up
the crabs.
That's fine. That's good, too.
Right.
That's a good image.
A hard cleaver, heavy cleaver. Actually, I would make a Baldo do it because I actually don't like
this
chopping
crab.
Up live crabs too much, I have to admit.
This crab is named Tony. This crab is named Tony. crab is named Tony.
Oh, boy. So, and then you saute them in a large bottomed, heavy bottomed pan and a little bit of hot oil. So I would saute the meat, everything in there, and add... at that point, you can begin to add water. I would add a little bit of cognac, tomato paste, bay leaf, just a few bay leaves, a couple of black peppercorns, a pinch of thyme. I would actually also add fresh tarragon because that's a flavor that I like, but you don't have to do that. And the carrot, celery, and onion. And the wonderful thing about a seafood stock is it just doesn't take as long to cook as a brown veal bone or chicken bone or any kind of brown stock. It takes hours and hours and hours. But with a seafood stock, you really can make it in 2 hours. And just once you bring it up to a boil, you start to skim what we call the scum off the top. And certainly using a whole crab and all the parts, you're going to have some scum come to the top. Just keep skimming it, which keeps the stock clear and clean looking, and really improves the flavor actually. And then turn it down to a simmer, so it just cooks very gently for those 2 hours, and then strain it. And I would reduce that down. The more you reduce it, the more flavor you're going to have, and you can make a really beautiful crab soup with that stock.
Two questions: one, with the cognac, do you ever flambé the shells?
I do. I also you compound the shells and actually really break them up. I've never found that necessary to do. But yes, the old way would be to pound the shells and to really flame it in the dry pan. I actually like the alcohol, a little bit of alcohol feeling to the stock, so I don't flame it.
I understand.
And then after I reduce it a little bit and make sure my flavor is where I want it, after I've strained it, reduced it, it's where I want it to be, then I add a light roux, which is 50% flour, 50% butter. That you make, so you make that in a separate pan. It wants to look like wet sand at low tide, and that is the perfect image of what a proper roux should look like, because you are making basically a white soup, not something with a lot of color. You want it to be a blonde roux, so when you go to mix your flour and butter together to make your roux, you want to keep tossing it around on low heat so that it does cook some of the flour flavor out, but that it And it begins to do its job, but you don't want it to color. Then you cool that down. If you have a hot stock, you need to have a cold roux, or vice versa. And in this case, we're talking about making something where the stock is already boiling.
So this is the next step to making the soup. So you have the, as you finish the stock, and then you strain the stock.
Mm-hmm.
You have that clear stock that's hot.
Mm-hmm. And I've reduced it down probably by at least 25%.
And maybe you made this roux in advance or when you're even starting
to start.
Oh,
you can make the roux whenever you want to, yes.
And you have that ready to go, and that's cold, the room temp.
Exactly. Actually, I would make the roux the first thing, and then I would start to make the stock so that it's either cooling down on the countertop or it's in your refrigerator cooling down. And then once you have to add roux to a boiling liquid, once you've had a little bit of roux, you don't want to add too much. You're using it as a thickening agent, and it also gives richness and shine to your soup as well. And you whisk it in, and you keep whisking it until it feels well incorporated. And all you have to do is coat a spoon with that soup that you're getting going, and you can see how if there are any little fine lumps still, you want to continue to whisk it and break those up, and then turn it down to a low simmer because that will scorch or burn in a heartbeat. And you really need to stay on the bottom of a pot once you add a roux to something like that. And keep stirring. Make sure you're scraping the bottom of the pot so that it never has a chance to adhere to the bottom of the pot. And you should be in a stainless steel pot for sure, because you have cream. You're going to add cream. So I would add, cream and whatever quantity you want. I like a lot of cream in my crab soup, so I add quite a bit. And then I season it with probably a little bit of cayenne pepper at this point, a little bit of fresh nutmeg, I also like to finish that soup with sherry, and I do that off the heat. I use Manzanilla sherry and do that off the heat. I don't have to cook that sherry.
So pretty dry. Mm-hmm. Manzanilla is a pretty darn dry, nutty.
And very pretty.
Light sherry. Yeah.
Yeah. And then garnish the soup with crab meat on pickup. When you go to plate it, you add the crab meat to the bowl and pour the hot soup over the crab meat rather than allowing anything to happen to that crab meat. That's the best way to handle it. And I garnish with a little chive, or you could add a chive oil or something like that too if you want. But I really just like fresh chives on top, finely chopped.
And the she crab soup, now traditionally the garnish would have been some of the roe from the female crabs.
Right. But I'm actually much more concerned with taking crabs that have roe in them from the population that we have. So we do not, I don't think that's happening anymore. That was a very old, back in Charleston in the old days when the people that were selling seafood would go through the streets and the cooks would be listening out for them to come by the homes. They would call out what they had, and they would call out she crabs because obviously those were prized and the most desired crab. And you're talking about over 100 years ago. So that's part of the history of making that soup for sure. Charleston she crab soup, therefore female crab, she crab. And that's why. Exactly.
So you want to do a chef's challenge?
Sure. Let's do it. Here you go, Tony. You go first. The last time I went first.
Oh, my. All right.
So I did a crab challenge. Apparently, Tony also didn't
follow
the rules.
No, I did not do a crab challenge. I didn't know there were rules. A crab challenge.
So who knows what my challenge is?
A crab challenge.
Okay. Well, yours is crabby, Tony. Fits you perfectly.
My goodness. All right.
Okay, go ahead.
Lump crab.
Yes.
This is lump crab. Jumbo lump crab.
Yes.
Maryland jumbo lump crab.
Whatever you want it to be, Tony.
Ooh. That's the right answer. Onion, celery, carrot, herbs. Heirloom tomato, extra virgin olive oil, kosher salt, pepper, hearts of palms?
No.
What? Elephant heart plums. Sorry, you have very exotic handwriting today. crowder peas, butter beans, ham hock. This is an end of summer sort of a challenge. It's all the things that are about to go away because crowder peas and butter beans, you can
so
get them
good.
Right now, but they're going
to
be gone.
Oh, go run to market. Well, actually, don't because then I won't be able to buy them. I'm sorry, I didn't
Lobster,
just say that.
Lime, La Bamba rice. All right, let's see.
Did you say the smoked ham hocks?
They are smoked.
It just says ham hock,
says
but
ham
they're smoked.
Hock. Yeah. I mean, my instinct, I mean, Lord knows I love to cook Spanish-style rice, you know, paella-type rice. If I have a little bit of, I have oil around. If I have an egg around, what I'd like to make is what they call in Catalonia, alioli, okay, with hopefully very nice fresh garlic, and have this mayonnaise sort of business. Because I want to take that jumbo lump crab and the lobster, and I want to make cakes out of it. Because I like lobster and crab together and things. Lobster has a little bit stronger flavor,
mm-hmm.
and the crab has a little bit more delicate sweetness. And I think that, I honestly would like to just kind of serve that on its own.
I haven't made lobster and crab cakes in a long time. They are good.
With that alioli, mm-hmm. you know, and a little bit of the fresh lime, and hopefully I've got some day-old bread to
Have everything in your pantry, right.
Yeah, use a rolling pin with some day-old French bread to make some breadcrumbs and just do nice pan-fried, honestly, even clarified butter. That lobster makes me want clarified butter for frying those guys and serve those. And I want to save, I'm going to use one of the heirloom tomatoes, one that's maybe a little bit overripe, and hold that aside. And the other one, I'm just going to slice it up and serve it because I want to enjoy it by itself, maybe with slices of those plums, just alternate those slices. And I've got this Greek basil that's oddly, almost really anise-y that I would love to have with that and just good oil and serve that as a cool course. But you know what I want to do is I want to make rice with the beans and the ham hock.
Definitely.
You know, with the crowder peas, which will cook a lot longer than the butter beans will.
Mm-hmm.
And so with some of the garlic and the onion and a little rosemary from the garden and some dried chili, maybe a Calabrian or arbol chili. Toast all those things and the rice in the bottom. Toast all those things in some oil to flavor the oil and flavor my paella pan. And then the rice goes in, and then you toast the rice with those things for a little while until you can almost smell a little popcorn-y kind of a thing. And to that, then you begin to add stock. And I've got, you said, all the things I have around. What I have is really, really good Gambert stock in my freezer, mostly guinea fowl, and that has really good deep flavor, and that's nice for beans and nice for the ham hock too. The ham hock, I want to reinforce that stock with a ham hock. That's probably the first thing I would have done had I been thinking. and then I'll pull a lot of the meat off that ham hock after probably 30-40 minutes where it's flavored and given a little bit of that porky edge to the bird stock, but not wiped out all the flavor from the ham hock. And have that all pulled so I can have that as a garnish inside the rice. Add that to the rice next with the stock. And you just kind of slowly add. La Bamba rice will take four times its volume, five times
sure
its volume
will.
In stock. Mm-hmm. And you keep it going slowly, nice and light, just enough to keep that stock bubbling. And the rice starts to absorb the flavors that are in that pan. That first, those first like 10 minutes are a big deal. Toasting the spice and toasting the rice with that, setting it up to be really dry and suck up all that stock, and then you gradually add. And you probably if it's fresh crowders, it's probably 30 minutes from the whole thing is probably 50 minutes, so probably about 20 minutes in you'd add your crowder peas, so they didn't get too overcooked, and about 10 minutes after that you'd add the butter beans. And the mirepoix I've totally neglected, but besides the onion, so I'm sorry.
You could have fortified your ham hock and game bird stock with
I could have. I could also
mirepoix.
Just be munching on the celery and the carrots.
Why not? Yeah. I do all the time.
Exactly.
That's my go-to food when I'm cooking. I take a carrot, take a piece of celery.
Don't pick up the wrong piece of mirepoix. You get onion breath all day.
I don't eat raw onions.
Like I said. But yeah,
that sounds
I would just finish with
great.
So there's your rice with the pulled ham hock and both beans and
mm-hmm.
And you put that in the oven to finish it. Just kind of toast it a little bit on the top and on the bottom.
Yeah.
At a real high temperature. You get a little bit crunchy on the top and the bottom.
I love making paella or risotto or any kind of rice like that where you have to stir it and really pay attention to it. It's just a wonderful experience. It's sort of one of the greatest things when you're cooking is to, it's that process of, as you said, you know, taking the time to work the spices and in the oil and really just allowing the rice to do its thing and developing as much flavor. Realize that anytime you have a starch, it's only going to be as good as what you have it absorb. So that flavor has to be there from the beginning.
So those little basic steps in the beginning.
Seasoning has to be there from the beginning.
Knowing how much to work it and how much, and when not to work it, when to let it just absorb. Because it really is, you kind of fold it in on itself a couple of times during cooking.
Well, that's the difference between paella and risotto, the process of making those two things. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And because if you do work it too many times, it's too starchy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not right.
You're basically making risotto.
Yeah. And that's not really what you're after.
And with paella also, I mean, you always think of beautiful garnishes on top and that the pan is such a, you know, it's all about the, it's not all about, but part of it is about the presentation and the beauty of that, you know, amazing pan coming out to the table and seeing, you know, beautiful vegetables on top or however you're garnishing it and everyone really getting to experience the dish that visually as well as from the way that it tastes.
Yeah, I think mine is a pretty, like, summer's going away.
That sounds good.
Let's have a nice little simple
snack. Would be delighted to eat that right now.
Out of the lobster crab cakes and the tomato and plum salad.
On La Bamba rice is one of my favorite rices to use, period. Whether it's making paella.
The quality of the rice itself.
Yeah, I mean, the rice is amazing from Spain. La Bamba.
All right. You ready for your challenge?
I am.
Are you sure you're ready for your challenge?
I am absolutely ready for my challenge. I'm excited.
When we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, I'm going to give Chef Cindy Wolf the impossible chef's challenge on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And here we go. Here is chef's challenge. That's right. It's
Amberjack.
Too entertaining.
Oh, God.
I didn't do
of
a crab challenge.
Okay, two amberjack whole.
Amberjack's in season. They're beautiful fish.
Black-eyed peas, eggplant, cherry tomatoes, okra, blue cornmeal, milk, onions, garlic, Italian parsley, fresh mint.
I was listening to strange music this morning.
Duck, bacon, and plums. That's funny. We had sort of, maybe two.
Plums are in season. It's an end of summer chef's challenge.
Whole amberjack. Well, seeing that I've never cooked an amberjack, nor have I ever seen one in my entire life.
They're really quite dangerous.
This really is quite a challenge. So I'm going to just cook them whole. And they're going to go, I'm going to gut them. And I'm going to slice the skin a little bit, very thinly, just to break it open, and rub it with oil and put, you gave me mint. Well, I have rosemary at home. So I'm going to put rosemary. Okay. I'm going to put rosemary in the cavity, and I'm going to put lemon slices in the cavity. I'm going to actually put black peppercorns in the cavity as well. So I'm going to roast it until it's absolutely sort of tender, quite frankly. I think if you roast this at a low temperature for a longer period of time. I have a feeling this is a very oily fish, right? Okay. So I'm going to...
Good flavor.
Yeah, I'm going to end up flaking it and working with it that way, which means I'm going to make rice. And you didn't give me rice, so I don't care. it's a ricey show.
Chef Cindy Wolf is going to make rice out of the air, ladies and gentlemen.
Blue cornmeal. Wow, I haven't worked with blue cornmeal in a long time. I think that the blue cornmeal is actually going to become sort of like polenta. So I'll cook it slowly with the milk and a little bit of salt until it's creamy, a tiny bit of butter and pepper. And actually, I'm not going to make rice. So I have my blue cornmeal that's going to be, like I said, it's going to seem like almost like creamy polenta. I'm going to fry the okra. So I'm going to make a salad with the black-eyed peas, the cherry tomatoes. I'm going to garnish it with hot fried okra, and I'm going to have roasted eggplant on the plate with it.
Sounds good.
So the roasted eggplant, I'm actually not going to make it the way I would normally. I'm actually going to slice it into thin rings and rub it with good extra virgin olive oil and salt, and I'm going to roast it until it's crispy. And the black-eyed peas, just cooking with the duck bacon and a little bit of the duck bacon just to flavor it, and a little bit of light chicken stock and Tabasco. So the black-eyed peas will be cooked and then drained, and I will discard that bacon. So I'll have black-eyed peas. I'll have my beautiful, thin, crispy slices of eggplant that I'm going to kind of stick in the black-eyed peas that I've tossed with the cherry tomatoes that I've quartered, and I've reserved every bit of the juice from those cherry tomatoes, which kind of ends up making its own vinaigrette in a way, and a little bit of extra virgin olive oil, salt and pepper, and I definitely am using that Italian flatleaf parsley and mint, actually, to just sort of a little bit of fresh herbs to garnish it. And then I'm going to thinly slice the rest of my duck bacon, which is going to be delicious, actually, with all of those flavors. That will be sort of laid around the salad, around the outside of the plate, with almost nothing touching it. So the person eating it can kind of decide what they want to do with the duck bacon. But if it's paper thin, that's going to be really pretty. So that is a thinly sliced duck bacon salad with a black-eyed pea and cherry tomato relish, seasoned with Italian parsley, fresh mint, a little bit of lime, extra virgin olive oil, some of that garlic, actually. I would like to have the garlic in there. And then the garnish of the hot okra and the thin slices of crispy eggplant. So I have a salad, and let's get back to that fish. So then the next course is going
to be sort of a big salad composé.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That actually sounds really good. Mm-hmm. And then the...
Because you got bitter, tangy, sweet in the cornmeal.
Mm-hmm.
You got the smoky, strong, spicy flavor of the duck bacon.
Oh, no cornmeal.
Oh.
No, I didn't use the cornmeal in the salad. That's for the amberjack.
Ah, I did.
So the cornmeal that I made into sort of like polenta, I'm just going to get a big bowl, and I'm just going to put the blue cornmeal, the creamy blue cornmeal, in the bottom of the bowl. And I'm going to put the flaked pieces of amberjack in the very center. I'm going to drizzle extra virgin olive oil all over the place. I'm going to add more of that Italian parsley, kind of in big pieces, and garnish with that. And actually, that's going to be that. And a little garlic in there. So actually, I would have added I think if I butter poached the garlic and the onion and added it, okay, back up. I'm going to butter poach the garlic and add it to the amberjack that's been flaked, but I'm going to do caramelized rings of the onions. So I really caramelize it, paper thin, saute it in high heat. And actually, those are going to just sort of go on top of that amberjack. So you have this caramelized onion business on top of the flaked amberjack, the garlic flavor in the creamy blue cornmeal, the parsley garnish, the extra virgin olive oil garnish. And the only thing I didn't use were these plums. So that's the...
Just eat some plums.
That was the... Yeah, and I'm with you. I love those plums so much. Right now, they're... Oh, gosh, I love them. I could just eat a million of them. So, yes, I would eat the plums while I was making this two-course meal.
And so if you were having supper, you'd walk up with your plate and you'd get some of the salad.
Mm-hmm.
And you would get... I guess you'd have to walk up with a bowl and get a big spoon of the creamy balloon cornmeal.
Yeah, the cornmeal in the center.
With the big flakes of amberjack.
Mm-hmm. And the caramelized onions.
And the sweet onions.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. It's very...
Drizzle extra virgin olive oil around.
Somehow strikes me as very like end of summer Native American sort of a...
I love that, actually. I think it sounds really good.
Combination of things.
Yeah.
That's those ingredients say, so...
Mm-hmm, definitely.
That's just you communing with the ingredients.
Exactly. Fun.
What do you want to drink with that?
Oh, I definitely want the
beer?
Wine that we had with the preserved tuna in Italy at the place where we had we ate on the picnic table. That's what I want. His sparkling wine.
That was Spain.
Prosecco. That was Spain, sorry.
That was Spain.
It wasn't Prosecco then.
That was Spain, and it was...
I get my countries mixed up.
The Pai Basco is Basque country.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and it was Chocoli.
Chocoli.
It was Chocoli, very low alcohol, lightly sparkling, very sort of like bright...
So good.
Yellow apple-y wine from...
I'm absolutely in love with that whole experience that we had there. Yeah. I will never, ever, ever, ever forget going to that That's one of the
two-year-old preserved tuna and wine for sparkling wine from Spain
breakfast.
For breakfast, yeah,
with onions on it. Like they, yeah. That had onions. I forget if they were cooked or raw.
No,
or
a little raw sweet red onions.
And the layout of the vineyards there is just, you can't even imagine that somebody can work those vineyards. They're trellised, which imagine if they were on the ground. Were any of them on the ground? They were all trellised, weren't they? But that whole place, it's like cliffs down to the ocean. I mean, it was just absolutely beautiful place. Chocoli. This wine.
Yeah, okay. Guattari is the village that that has that particular winery.
Spain. Beautiful experience.
Basque is so easy to speak. Choma de Chanis is the name of the the winery. Go for it, spelling it.
Right. There's got to be an X in something else.
There's an X in everything.
An unusual letter in there.
There's an X in everything. And one thing I don't know is if it's, I don't know their harvest time. Most of the world, I usually know when it's time. And it's funny, in Bordeaux, it's such big money, tracking when harvest is going to be, when it's allowed, and all of these kinds of things is craziness.
Do you think that what's happening with the Chinese markets will affect the prices of Bordeaux?
Absolutely. That's the Chinese currency effect. We had Jeffrey Davies on the program. The Chinese introduction to the world economy and their interest in wine, especially in Bordeaux, as a high end, you know, a commodity, is a gigantic thing. And if their currency is weaker, they're looking to send less money out of China, which means that they're going to be buying less of those wines, which means those prices will weaken a bit. That doesn't mean that the Bordelais will necessarily drop them.
Right. So when will the Bordelais go into harvest?
Some whites are soon. The Sauvignon Blanc, the Semillon, the Muscadel, Sauvignon Gris, all this sort of business, the whites in Bordeaux are soon. They're usually 30, 45, 60 days earlier than the reds. In a few very special sites, they hang longer, but the question of like hang time for fruit, it's kind of an easy one. That wines that have more to communicate, if they're living on the vine longer, they've had a longer life, they've got more to say. But the thing is, can you sustain them that long? Will they actually be able to be as healthy, you know, to harvest as they should be, to have the fruit, to have that, so we have enough flavor to really have enough joy to transmit that you want to listen to the story.
Right.
You know, that's the hard thing. With reds in Bordeaux, Cabernet Sauvignon is almost always the last harvest. So that you're talking about the wines in those villages that are dominated by that grape, Pauillac, Saint-Julien, Margaux, principally. Then everything else is pretty much Saint-Estèphe to a lesser extent. Everything else is 50-50 Merlot Cab, more or less. South and west, and then east towards Libourne, where you see Saint-Emilion, Pomerol, and all of those satellite appellations. That's all Merlot dominated. Merlot comes in earlier. Merlot comes in bigger. Honestly, it's one of the funny things is you think of big-bodied wines. Usually in the States, you think of Cabernet Sauvignon. Body usually is more attached to the alcohol level of the wine. And the sort of the breadth and volume of it in your mouth. And Merlot tends to have, it's an earlier harvest and usually higher alcohol than Cabernet Sauvignon. But most Bordeaux wines are blended. Those are the two most important. Cabernet Franc harvest in between. You're looking at, there is no typical year anymore. That's the thing is with the climate change. And climate change and winemaking style change and chasing particular tastes in the public, all those harvest dates are different. In general, red wines are harvested in Bordeaux from second week of September through third week of October, one way or another.
Okay.
But all the specific questions and
choices.
That's
a longer window than I would have thought. I didn't realize it was that long.
Well, a lot of the estates are huge.
Okay.
I mean, that's the thing. Is
yeah, takes a while.
Lafitte Rothschild produces 100,000 cases of wine a year. And a good vintage at, you know, $10,000 a case for futures.
Wow.
2 years before you can get the wine, you can pay for it for $10,000 a case, and they make 100,000 cases of it.
Oh. Wow.
So if you don't think that that's big business, you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The only place in France where you go and see wine growers, quote unquote, and see them in suits and ties, and a lot of the states are owned by the insurance companies and whatnot, is Bordeaux. That being said, there are little tiny growers and producers that are really interesting. That
absolutely,
because Bordeaux is a huge region. A lot of France is smaller. Is the farmer, viticulture, you know, the big brands. Most of the brands that everyone knows from France, whether it's Champagne houses or Bordeaux estates, most of those big brands are owned by some kind of a conglomerate at this point, or some multinational, or a very, very wealthy, well-known individual, that kind of thing.
I can't imagine.
That's a different world.
The weight of being that small farmer and knowing that you have to pick at the right day, you know, that hail could come or a storm could come and damage the vines.
Or you can't send your kid to college.
Just,
they
run
the equivalent
such a
economic
risk
feeling,
when, you know, they come up with, when they decide when to actually start to pick, because the, you know, environmental and the weather factors.
If you don't harvest at the right time, your quality may not be what it could be. And everyone will be like, oh, you know, Francois, he always pulls the trigger early, you know. And you get a reputation for being a little too conservative. And then a writer hears about it from some other writer. And the writers are, you know, they're trying to make their bones. They're being judgmental about stuff. That stuff, all the wine gossip boards and all the wine rating things and all that kind of. Know a merchant. Taste wine.
Mm-hmm.
Make decisions about what tastes good to you. That goes a very, very long way. But yeah, but yes, we are coming up on harvest time, and yes, it is going to be interesting. And some years, it's funny, like 2013, disaster year for red wine, especially in France. We're talking about France a lot, but it's anywhere. Imagine right now if you're a wine grower in Washington State or Oregon with the wildfires.
Yeah, well, that must be devastating.
I mean, that's their
oh,
people.
My goodness.
Talking to people up there
imagine.
Who are like, yeah, we're going to work our butts off all year, and maybe in 3 years we'll start to have income again, you know.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Those poor families.
That's another planet.
Hmm.
Well, that's. I think we're out of time. That's.
Yeah. So we hit a couple of different categories there.
Well, sorry to see summer go.
It's not over yet, but it is coming.
I'm sure you'll have
a big
close of summer party.
Yes.
Of course you will. If you want to check out any Formula Wolf podcast, the Formula Programs, you can look us up on WYPR's website, WYPR.org, and look on the Formula Wolf page. And all of the previous live programs and recorded programs are there for you. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
I'm on Instagram under Chef Wolf and on Twitter under Chef Cindy Wolf.
And you can write us if you'd like at Foreman Wolf at WYPR.org. And thanks for listening to Foreman Wolf on WYPR. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Have a great Sunday.